This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 21st of July 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated design show. I'm your host, Josh Fennett. In this episode of the show, we tour one of Los Angeles' modernist treasures, the residence of the late Richard Neutra.
This is a very livable house that is also very much part of living outdoors. It's tied to the California dream.
Next up, we explore an exhibition in Madrid that celebrates the virtue of coming second and reimagines how the Spanish capital would look if these avant-garde architectural creations had ever broken ground.
They would represent fresh air for Madrid, not only from the architectural point of view, but from economical point of view, a political point of view, and also from a landscape point of view.
Plus, we sit down with Swiss industrial designer Yves Bahar to discuss the future of the home. All that to come and plenty more besides right here on Section D on Monocle 24. Nature near, nature far was one of the main edicts of Austrian-American modernist architect Richard Neutra. The work of the man named by Time magazine as second only to Frank Lloyd Wright in expertise is nowhere better exemplified than at his sunny glass and steel Los Angeles home. Designed in 1932, the VDL house, as it's known, is a lateral, large windows structure where he lived with his wife Dionne and three children right up until his death in 1970. With views over the San Gabriel mountain range and the watery expanse of the Silver Lake Reservoir to its front, the house is skirted with lush vegetation and remains one of the finest examples of the California modern style. Our contributing editor, Tom Morris, took a tour of the house with Sarah Lorentzen, director and resident of the VDL House and associate professor and chair of architecture at Cal Poly University, Pomona.
There's usually no better way to discover what makes a great architect unique than looking at their own home. And that's certainly the case with the VDL House, designed by Richard Neutra in the 1930s, a place which remained his home up until his death in 1970. It was a pioneering project which he got two goes at, first in 1932 and then again in 1963 when he rebuilt it following a disastrous fire. The home was donated to a special foundation by Neutra's wife Dionne in 1980, and its garden house, a dinky bungalow that survived the fire, is lived in now by VDL director Sarah Lorentzen. To this day, it's a cosy, peaceful place, especially sitting in the inner courtyard under the broad range of a Chinese elm tree. Under the Californian sun, it's hard to see where nature begins and Neutra's very own home ends, as Sarah explains.
Neutra studied in Vienna and he served in World War I, and then after that he went and worked for a horticulturalist in Switzerland, which is where he met his wife. And he was always very interested in the connection of inside and outside and the connection of nature and healthful living and ideas about the climate. And so that experience, sort of learning about the environment, really infused all of his later projects. And certainly you can see that here, where basically there's, in the front house, there's a series of the whole facade is on the ground floor, is glass panels, and then there's a second layer of glass which then sees into the courtyard. And then the garden house has a big sliding glass door with then another set of glass which goes to the outside.
So we've now come upstairs into this wide, bright living room with the amazing view of the reservoir. Talk me through about how this room sort of exemplifies what Neutra was trying to do.
So in this room we see some of the tenets of Neutra's architecture. One of them, again, is the connection of inside and outside and framing views. So to the north, there are the San Gabriel Mountains, which is an enormous mountain range right on the edge of Los Angeles. And what he did is he created some high windows that would frame the mountains almost like a picture window. And then the tall wall beneath it also then hides the neighboring houses. So you get this sort of perfect framed view of the mountains. Another part of it was to have built-in furniture. So there was really about maximizing space and about sort of avoiding waste.
And two of his famous boomerang chairs. So we're now in one of the two bedrooms in the main house. We're in the smaller one, which I think quite gentlemanly of him was he gave to his wife.
Right. So this was Dione's bedroom. It's very, very small. It's 7 feet by 9 feet. So that's about 2.5 meters by 3 meters. And it's really built like a ship's cabin. It has cabinets everywhere. So there's closets and storage space on every wall. And then there's mirrors on the two sides so that you feel like it's a larger space. And there's a very high bed that really feels like the berth of a ship. Mm-hmm. Interestingly enough, the Neutra, which we consider sort of this modern male architect, was very interested in domesticity and making things functional. So the house really works well as a domestic space. So there's, like I said, there's storage everywhere. The kitchens are actually laid out to make them work. There's drawers underneath the bed so that you can put the sheets there. And even he had this funny idea to have a piano hinge on one side of the bed so that you could swing the bed out since it's against the wall and easily make the bed. I can show it to you.
This bed is just one example of how Neutra, a true modernist, embraced technology to make a space livable and functional. In the kitchen, there are built-in can openers, a waste disposal unit, and an elevator that runs up all 3 floors. But Neutra also embraced modernity in the very materials he used to build the house. He was, after all, a pioneer of using steel to construct residential projects.
The house is purposely built with things that we would still find available at a local home store. The counters are formica and the floors are linoleum, and there's acoustical tile, and there's all of the cabinets are plywood. These are all readily available manufactured products that come in certain sizes, and that's the size that they're used. This isn't about craftsmanship in the way that like the Gamble house would be, where you need craftsmen to put this together.
Why does this house still work? Why do you think it's still such a pleasure to live in?
Even though we identify it as, I guess now the term is mid-century modern, which is a term that was coined to describe this kind of house, or California modern, which is really about a kind of lifestyle. So it's as much about the artistry of the house as the lifestyle that's associated with the house. You know, when you come in here, you can imagine the party. There's pillows on the carpets, on the ground, and you can see sitting, putting your feet up and, I don't know, smoking a joint and looking out of the window. I mean, there is definitely that association when people come here, and that you feel free because you can see everything, or you're not penned in. There's very little solid walls. Most of it is glass. And not glass in a way that makes it precious. You know, it's not a sort of perfect glass box. It's sort of series of glass panels that open and close, and a lot of materials and a lot of different kinds of spaces that you can really occupy. This is a very livable house that is also very much part of living outdoors and having a kind of relaxed and ideal landscape. It's tied to the California dream.
That was Monocle's very own Tom Morris taking us on an audio tour of the late architect Richard Neutra's splendid house and one-time studio in Los Angeles, California. You're listening to Section D with me, Josh Fennett. Now, it's only appropriate that for our second item of today's show, we focus on the act of coming second. Survey any given city and the architectural vernacular will invariably be shaped by a history of grand public commissions. It's in the train stations, the grand government ministries and the urban renewal projects, all of which have been put out to tender, contested by ambitious architectural firms, and won, one would hope, by the best-fitting proposal. However, City Hall decision-making is often characterised by bureaucratic inertia rather than bravado, and many more avant-garde projects find themselves relegated to second place as officials opt for a safe bet over a statement piece. In Madrid, an exhibition at the College of Architects explores what the Spanish capital might have looked like if these second-place projects had been built instead. While history isn't always kind to those who finish second, young curators Gonzalo Pardo and Paula García Marcedo believe that, while runners-up might not always be better, they're normally more interesting. Monocle's Liam Aldous visited their Segundo Premio exhibition on opening night.
I'm at Madrid's College of Architects, where everyone is celebrating coming second. The DJ is spinning 90s tunes that only ever made it to number 2 on the charts, and the walls are lined with grandiose projects that never made it off the drawing board. I asked the exhibition's two curators if, by playing it safe, this city ultimately missed out on real architectural greatness.
I think it depends on the project. Of course, there are projects that second prizes that are much better than the first one, and there are first ones that are a very good one. They are very well chosen.
But the thing I think is most interesting is that we can think of a history of Madrid through the competitions, because all the programs of the city, the main programs, the most important buildings have been built through this kind of structure or contract.
Also, you get to understand the context of the way cities are built as well, because lots of political factors, economic factors play into why certain projects are selected.
Of course. There were the skyscrapers around the 60s, 70s. There were the cultural programs in the 90s. In the 90s, there was the cultural programs like Reina Sofia and also Prado. Later on, it was the Olympic programs, Ciudad de la Justicia. We also can see that most of the competitions held in the last century were in the last decade.
The first project we look at is the extension of the Spanish Central Bank, which was ultimately won by Rafael Moneo's markedly conservative, seamless continuation of the original building. The runner-up, by José Antonio Corral and Ramón Vázquez Molazún, proposed to open up the block with a bold, modern design, but it was perhaps a little too bold for the bank's board.
It's modern, it has an interior facade that you can see from the street that's curtain glass, decorated in kind of Arabesque style, trying to relate with the old building through the decoration, but in the other side, that relates to the small street. The other side is like a very simple and modern building.
Considering who the client was, do you think it was a surprise that they went with a more conservative project?
No, for sure no. I think that the Spanish Central Bank, it's so conservative that they want to show that kind of image of everything is going to be okay, everything is going to be the same, we are not going to do anything strange or weird or whatever, no? So in that case, it's logical, no, that this couldn't be the first one.
Another couple of grand projects, the new Madrid Convention Center and the much-anticipated City of Justice Legal Precinct, are conspicuous on two counts. Both projects attracted a plethora of visionary proposals, but due to the economic crisis, neither managed to get off the ground.
I think that they are broken dreams because they begin to be built in, in an era that was a crisis, so nothing could be done. I think they were quite interesting. But not just because of the bigness of the project, because they would represent new, fresh air for Madrid, not only from the architectural point of view, but from economical point of view, a political point of view, and also from a landscape point of view. I think the first one was incredible. It was a metaphor of optimist about the sun that never sets in Madrid. Ciudad de la Justicia was interesting because it was a kind of system which the most interesting thing was that there were many foreign architects for the first time in Madrid that they were going to build new buildings in Madrid.
The next runner-up was for a sporting complex that ultimately became the controversial 300 million euro Caja Mágica. In this instance, Gonzalo believes the city lost a potential masterpiece by local architects Mansilla y Tuñón.
For me, this project probably is one of the best of the exhibition. It's very interesting because it's a building which is linked with the landscape, through some kind of cuts in the stadium. They are very imaginative architects, and this building was done from the smash of a Coca-Cola can. And then they did some cuts, and the result was the building.
And do you think because it was so daring, is that why ultimately it wasn't selected? Because the end result, the one that was chosen, is just a big silver box.
Well, the first one is a quite normal box, but I think that they chose that one also for political reasons, because Dominique Perrault, which is a French architect, he wanted to build in Madrid, and they give him this one, no? This is his first build in Madrid.
I think the main issues of the city, the main conflicts, are discussed through competitions. Trace a geography of a struggle between politic decisions, social concerns, competitions, architectonic ideals.
Do you think then the more daring a city's infrastructure and its architecture, the healthier it is as a city, or maybe there's less conflict and people can agree?
Well, I don't think that people can agree, and that's a good situation. Conflict is inherent to life, so that's okay. But I think that buildings are one of the most important elements of our heritage, and we all know that, because when you go to Rome, you see the Colosseum, and it's a very old building. So it's our heritage. I think it's an important decision how to construct a city.
Perhaps it would be also interesting to know what the second prize was for the commission of the Colosseum. Maybe it was an even bolder Colosseum.
It could be, of course.
That was our Madrid correspondent Liam Aldous there, finding out about the Segundo Premio exhibition at the Spanish capital's College of Architects. Still to come on the show, we talk about the future of the home with Swiss industrial designer Yves Bahar. We also head to Toronto to speak with some of the architects behind the venues for the ongoing Pan American Games.
Location is everything. London's Canaletto Tower is set by water and at the meeting place of four vibrant central London neighbourhoods. It bridges the capital's creative, financial and tech hubs of Shoreditch, Islington, Clerkenwell and the City. A dynamic prime location full of life. Canaletto London and Section D on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Section D with me, Josh Fennett. Once limited to gimmickry and clap-activated lamps, technology in the home is now developing at an unprecedented rate. And it's not just technology for the few. One man who is more keen than most to usher in this new era is prolific Swiss industrial designer Yves Bahar. Bahar has already designed the August Smart Lock, a keyless smartphone-controlled lock for the home. And last week saw the release of a smart thermostat he has designed for British Gas's Hive project, a heating system that allows people to control the temperature of their homes remotely. Monocle's intrepid reporter Henry Rees-Sheridan made himself at home in the violin factory in London and met Yves to learn more about the future of technology in the home.
Hive and British Gas collaborated with us, Fuse Project, for the last 2 years. And we built an entirely new industrial design and entirely new set of technologies, as well as new on-device user interface for UK homes. And contrary to most tech products, this one is not made for early adopters. This one is actually targeted at every, you know, customer of British Gas or not. In fact, every UK consumer. And so needs to be much more approachable, easy to use, and fit within the expectations of British homes.
And what are some of the distinguishing design features of the product that make it in keeping with our principles?
Functionally, thermostats in the UK do different things than other places in the world. Your boiler, hot water, is connected. The heat is connected as well to the same device. And then there's also added functionality such as the boost function and multi-zones. So technically, it does quite a few things. Visually, I don't really believe in adding a lot of displays in the home, a lot of flashing lights and distracting visual technologies. So the display only comes on when you need it. It's hidden behind a mirror surface. And so it ends up being, I would say, you know, discreet and non-technological feeling at first.
You don't like screens, do you? What's wrong with screens?
Well, we all use screens every day and on our phones and laptops, but I do think that's enough. I mean, I don't think we need more screens on our bodies, more screens in our homes. In fact, the home is a place where I think technology needs to be very discreet. The technology needs to be in the background. And what's in the foreground is the functionality of the product and also how you live. You know, when I pull my phone out of my pocket, it sends a signal. I'm not present. I'm not here, you know, with my family. I'm doing something else. So if I can operate my home, control my home, whether it's with the Hive thermostat or the August smart lock, without having to use my phone, that's real technological progress in my opinion.
Now, the Hive thermostat has been developed in collaboration with British Gas. The development and implementation of technology like this on a mass scale is going to inevitably involve collaboration with large utilities providers like them. Do you think this is going to be a help or hindrance to smart design in the home becoming mainstream and also being good design?
When I first came to London to meet with the Hive team, their setup was very surprising to me. It was a startup in a sort of sweaty, crowded room in London, and it felt much more like a startup culture in San Francisco than sort of a large utilities company in a business complex. And so I was pleasantly surprised. I was actually excited because the Hive team is sort of very can-do, very much about prototyping, about trying things, about building them quickly. And so I think what we're seeing is, in fact, larger companies adopting the principles, the rhythm, the speed of startups, and in turn, creating very strong works, very strong technologies, very strong interactions for their customers.
Now, the Dutch designer Rem Koolhaas has recently expressed concern at the potentially sinister effects of smart home technology, especially the way in which the amount of data it could collect might compromise our privacy. Is that a concern that you share?
Well, Rem has been quite vocal about his distaste for technology in the home. I actually think it's the reverse. I think we need more technologies in the home. We need comfort to be provided by us, not purely in aesthetic terms, but also in functional terms. And technology can do that. Technology can make us more aware of the environment. Technology can make us more comfortable. Technology can help us save energy, be more sustainable. There's all kinds of ways that if technology is designed in a human way, it actually will contribute greatly to design, architecture, and pleasures of living in your home.
You've worked in a remarkably wide range of different design projects. Do you have a common approach to all your different projects, or do you approach one individually? And if there is a common approach, what is it?
Each project is very much about context. So, like other architects, we tend to not want to have a repetitive style. We want our work to be about a specific solution, about a specific idea. I think what connects all of our projects is that each of them have a big idea. The Hive connected thermostat is really about how technology is becoming easy to use, beautiful in everybody's homes, not just in early adopters' homes. For August, for example, the August smart lock, the notion is that our homes, now we can control our homes as if we were there, even though we're not there personally. I think all those, those are big ideas. It's a big change for people to go from the old way that we're doing things to the new ways that we're doing things. And if you maintain sort of the notion of something important changing in their lives, but is yet very approachable, very human, very easy, then I think you're ushering forward new technologies and new designs in a way that changes the world a little bit.
That was Monocle's very own researcher, Henry Rees Sheridan, speaking with the industrial designer, Yves Bahar. You're listening to Section D with me, Josh Fennett. To end the show, we head to Canada's largest city, which is currently in the throes of hosting the Pan American Games. The sporting event takes place every 4 years, and this July, athletes from across the Americas have decamped to Toronto. Considered a warm-up for the Olympics, the event is hosted in a number of venues around the city. Monocle's Kane Knapp spoke to one of the architecture firms behind some of the buildings to get a sense of what the legacy of the Games may be.
I'm Bill Nankervell. I'm the CEO of B+H Architects.
The Games are fast approaching. I'm speaking, of course, of the Pan Am and Pan American Games. If you wouldn't mind just giving a brief overview as to B+H's role in the Games.
Yeah, we were selected to be the overall planning and design and compliance architects for this. This is a role sort of unique in Ontario. We were selected to both establish all of the design criteria and specifications for a handful of new venues to be built under a AFP, a design, build, and finance type delivery. As well, we were hired to be the architects, the lead architects on a number of other new venues that were being built with a more conventional construction delivery method.
You mentioned a few buildings you guys were directly involved with. What buildings were those?
The primary one was the Markham Aquatic Center, which is being used for water polo and badminton and table tennis, actually, because it's more than just an aquatic center. It's a large sports facility that's the center of a new hub in Markham for sports and recreation facilities. We're also the architects for the University of Toronto's Field Hockey Center, where field hockey will be done there, the first really dedicated facility of its kind in Toronto. We renovated the Etobicoke Olympium, which for many years was the only 50-meter swimming pool in Toronto. And, you know, those I grew up in the 70s doing competitive swimming. It was one of the few places you could actually go with a full 50 meters. But we've given it a new life and kind of brought it into the 21st century. So it's a great venue right now.
Fantastic. And now I understand that B plus H has a few kind of core design values. If you wouldn't mind just briefly going over how those design values manifested themselves in the buildings that you produced for the games.
Okay. Well, you know, all of these venues were really about the community legacy. They were meant to be very high performing. You know, they were where athletics endeavors can be done at literally at a kind of world record setting pace in the sports that are coming for the Pan Am and the Parapan Games. But they also had to function as great community facilities. All of the new venues actually are either owned by educational institutions or municipalities. So they really belong to the kind of the cities and the communities and the people that were involved with them. So durability, sustainability, you know, highly environmentally responsible design and buildings that are made to last and be used by the people around them. Those really were the core values we were looking at here.
Right. You spoke briefly there about legacy. And being from Vancouver myself, quite a big thing in the run-up to the Olympics was, you know, how are these buildings going to be used after the games? They're going to be a skating rink. They're going to be, you know, a velodrome, like you said, an aquatic center, a place for table tennis for all of just over a month. So just briefly, how does B plus H envision the legacy of these buildings?
They were, in fact, almost designed with the legacy end use in place first. And then you take a look and you just say, okay, and then what does this building also have to do for approximately 4 weeks of high-level international competition once in the summer of 2015? And from that point, the stakeholders, the owners and operators of these buildings in the legacy thing were at the table with us right from the very start. So they weren't designed only with the games in mind. Certainly, there are aspects of the games that you really had to take in consideration, you know, broadcast lighting and cabling and access to the broadcast trucks, the large crowds, the temporary security, all of, you know, accommodating volunteers, all of those things are what I actually referred to as the overlay, the temporary fit out that's required to host something like the Pan Am and Parapan games. But it was the legacy use of them in terms of the architecture, the planning, the functionality that really drove the design from the start.
That was Kane Knapp from our Toronto Bureau, investigating the likely design legacy of the 2015 Pan American Games, which will continue until the 26th of July. And sadly, that's all we have time for on this episode of Section D with me, Josh Fennett. We'll be back at the same time next week, and if you missed any of this week's show or our back catalogue, you can head to monocle.com, SoundCloud or iTunes to listen again. As usual, today's show was produced by David Pleasant and edited by Alex Funnell. You can also contact the show's producer, David, at dmp@monocle.com with any comments, queries or questions. As always, thanks for listening and goodbye.